This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is Afternoons on Dubai Eye 103.8.
I'm Helen Farmer. Fantastic to have you with us on the Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast. Talking health on today's episode, both mental and physical, and discussing body image. Alarming numbers out of the States. Parents saying two-thirds of their kids are struggling with negative body image. So we brought in the experts, teacher and teen coach Kieron McBreen and eating psychology coach Florence Gillet. We're talking heart disease ahead of World Heart Day with a young woman living with a pacemaker and talking prevention as well. What causes varicose veins? We asked Dr. Murali from King's College Hospital.
Healthy habits
on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
We're talking teens this hour, and a study came out just last week that showed that 2 in 3 parents say their child is self-conscious about the way they look, and many have noticed their child making negative comments about their appearance. So what can we do as parents? What can we be looking out for? How can we negate this? To find out more, joined now by Kieron McBreen, who's a teen and parent mindset coach and educator at the Swiss School, and author and podcaster too. Now, we're going to be talking a little bit about the data around this, and we're going to be hearing other people's stories as well, Kieron, but I'm curious to hear what your own body image was like as a teen, and maybe even now, if you wouldn't mind sharing.
Yeah, first of all, Helen, thanks for having me, and thanks for addressing this really important topic.
It's a scary one, to be honest. As a parent, I find it a really scary one.
Yeah. I grew up hating my body.
Really?
Literally hating my body. My slim frame, I just hated it. You know, it's one of them situations where you want to be anything else but what you have. And it stayed with me. It stayed with me throughout adulthood. I'm still not fully satisfied, but now who is?
You know, I don't think anyone is.
And that's it. You know, so you kind of grow out of it. Mm-hmm. And I wish I could advise my 16-year-old self to say, look at Kieron, don't worry about it. You know, you can only control what you can control. There's only so much push-ups I can do in the bedroom to try and change my physique that inevitably mm-hmm. doesn't make that much of a difference, because it's your body.
We can train.
We can eat. But it's your body. It's what we've been given, and we just have to work with that.
It's so hard because, I mean, I'm 40 now, and you know, when I think about what I was surrounded by as a teen, I would probably buy a magazine, maybe a couple of magazines a month. And you could see, you know, a bit of TV. I mean, I have to say, Pamela Anderson didn't really help on a Saturday night. But there was my friends that I would compare myself to, and the odd kind of, you know, model in a magazine and a bit of TV. But it's nothing compared to what teens are up against now when we think about those constant comparisons, and not just comparisons in media, but unrealistic false comparisons.
And this is the key. It's false. You know, it's we've highlighted before, Helen, it's the Instagram versus reality.
Mm-hmm,
it's what we see every day. We scroll, we like, we comment, whatever we do. But the reality is it's not real, mm-hmm. because it's photoshopped. It's whatever it
posed.
Is, but it's not real.
I know. But, you know? And we know that, as, you know, somewhat social media savvy adults. But I mean, I still compare myself. I thought losing 40, 45 kilos would make me happy and delighted with my body. And it has. I mean, I'm happier, but I'm not delighted. And then you try to talk to a teenager about it whose brain is not fully developed. It's just not. And how can you then have these conversations about what is real, what is realistic, about what attitude you should have and the love you should have for yourself and your body when there's just so much up against you?
And it's so easily said now at our age, but we got to always bring ourselves back to when we were 16, 14, mm-hmm. whatever it is. Mm-hmm. We cannot tell a teenager how they should feel or should behave in a certain area that affected ourselves. You know, it's one of them things that you have to ride it out. Mm-hmm. It's experience. It's growing up. It's growing up and it's accepting.
So tell us then about the work that you've been doing, because I know you actually dedicated a whole chapter to teens and body image in your book, Listen Up, which is about teenage life and challenges and opportunities. And what were some of your findings through exploring that topic?
Yeah, so WIPMIN, there was 48 countries involved in the research. And, you know, I picked two students to do a one-to-one interview with on this topic. Body image was actually voted the third most challenge of the group of students involved in the research.
You know, I want to know what's one and two.
Yeah. Can you guess?
School.
Academic pressure.
Yeah.
Academic pressure, number one, and anxiety, number two.
Interesting.
Now, the anxiety one, obviously, body image would come into that as well. But body image was identified as up there with number three. And there's two contrasting stories. One was Ibrahim. And Ibrahim was slim. Because he was slim, he was called skinny. Mm. He was academic, you know, so he wasn't involved in sports. And PE was a hard time for Ibrahim. One particular scene where he had to play rugby and, you know, the shorts wouldn't fit him and the boys in the change room were laughing at him. And, you know, this is a really detrimental effect on his long-lasting mental health. The sad thing about Ibrahim's story, Helen, was his own family, his aunts. Hey, boy, skinny would be called, you know, skinny this, skinny that. Mm-hmm. And it used to break his heart. He couldn't understand why are they calling him skinny? It's not nice. It's simply not nice, you know. And if I can bring it to me for a second, I'm actually passionate about this word too, because it's not a nice word, you know. And you might call somebody skinny, but you don't call somebody fat. So
well,
why is it?
Do people do?
Oh, I don't know. Why is it okay to call somebody skinny and not fat? You know.
Well, I think it's often what triggers an individual. Yeah, I'm sure some people would love to be called skinny. I'm sure some people would love to say you've had weight put on. But yeah. So much of that is what you grow up with, what your parents are putting onto you.
That's it.
And I think that's what kind of scares me as a parent, is like, how can I raise, maybe not like I'm so body positive I want to shout through the rooftops, but I want kids who are healthy and happy and secure and capable and just in the world and okay with it, you know? And I think that's a really, really big challenge, because as parents we are up against so much to try and get there.
Absolutely. And you know, so Abraham himself had a difficulty, and I do, with the term skinniness. Mm-hmm. Now, the other story, Helen, was Fatima, who was on the larger side of things. And because she was large for her age, the girls in the changing room, and you know, would be giving her a hard time. Mm-hmm. She was developed more than other girls her age. Mm-hmm. And she was good at sport. She was up against the boys and she was being successful in sport. But because she wasn't fitting in, mm-hmm, to the stereotypical,
like kind of that feminine.
Absolutely. Yeah. Then she was giving a hard time and she was called lots of nasty names, to unfortunately led to a suicide attempt. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's a very deep and heartbreaking story, you know.
This is a fantastic book for any, not just teens, but also parents of teens and parents of young children who are anticipating this chapter in their lives, chapters looking at different topics. So do check out Kieran's book. We'll send you a link to that if you want it on 4001. Tina on the SMS saying, I think puberty is hard, full stop. As a parent, I always compliment and appreciate my children. I never say negative comments to them, as I know their bodies are changing. No name on this one saying, is the heaviest sibling. I hated the comparisons my parents and even teachers would make between me and my younger brother. I'm healthy now, but it was miserable at the time. We've got a number of questions we're going to as well, but Pam says, I'm a grown woman and my mum still makes the odd comment about my weight, and that affects me even now. People have no idea how small words can have a big impact. And when these words are said continuously to a child or teen, they definitely carry this into adulthood. They're absolutely right, Pam.
Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Now, there are, of course, initiatives that support people fostering a healthy body image, the, you know, body positivity, body neutrality movement, more prominent than ever. And lots of celebrities are speaking about it. But kids are still struggling. And this week, the University of Michigan's C.S. Mott Children's Hospital published a national poll on children's health that highlighted the severity of body image issues amongst children and teens. They surveyed nationally in the U.S. a sample of parents of at least one child, aged age between 8 and 18, and nearly two-thirds of parents said their child is self-conscious about some aspect of their appearance, with skin concerns like acne, weight and hair being the top issues reported. Joining us in the studio this afternoon to explore this a little bit more is Kieron McBreen. He is a teacher, a parent and mindset coach and an educator at the Swiss School. And Kieron, it's an interesting time, last 24 hours, because we've just had news there that masks are no longer compulsory in schools. And I mean, I for one am delighted, and I know you personally are, but I wondered if you've picked up on any anxiety or reluctance from children, teens, to remove the mask related to body image.
Yeah, Helen, I'm a massive believer of opening up conversation. And this morning, the first thing I said to the students was, how are you feeling about this? You know, and it's something maybe parents need to ask their children, because it's not a happy time for everybody. You know, I had a student last year, Helen, who wouldn't swim. And I finally got to the bottom of it. And the reason was that she wouldn't take off her mask.
She was afraid.
She was afraid to take off her mask. Similar conversations were coming up this morning with my students. There's an element of comfort with the mask on, a protection element. The mask is literally a mask.
It's a barrier.
It's a barrier. And taking it off now is a big deal for many. And the wonderful thing is, I kept saying this morning, you know, this is a choice. Mm-hmm. There's no pressure on anybody to do anything. We've all got a choice.
And I hope there isn't. I hope it's not going to become a point of, you know, difference or belittling or bullying for someone to make that choice, whether that's an adult or a child in any environment across the UAE. And I hope, you know, parents and teachers are going to support their children.
Absolutely.
And also, if it is a point of anxiety, to understand the underlying cause of that, yeah, that might be manifesting in a behaviour of choosing to wear a mask for not COVID-related reasons.
This is it. You know, if I think when I was a teenager, you know, I used to get this acne down on my side of my face, and I would have loved to wear a mask to cover it up, you know. But I know students and adults as well who got, you know, dental work done because their face has been covered. Mm-hmm. You know, lots of braces in schools because it's a good time to get it.
Absolutely.
Now that's been exposed. Mm-hmm. So it's a very daunting time. So it's important that we're supportive tomorrow.
Well, which leads me to ask, you know, what, if anything, is being done in school to address body image issues? You know, the numbers there are really scary, to be honest, about how children, young people are feeling about their bodies. How is this being woven into curriculum or conversations? And I mean, I think the fact that you had that this morning is fantastic.
Yeah.
Is there anything official or not really?
Well, nothing official, but, you know, as teachers, you know, we've got some amazing teachers. The education system here is fantastic. And teachers are so relatable to teenagers compared to when we were at school and the generation before. Mm-hmm. You know, lots of deep conversations take place, and that's where learning really takes place. Educating the child is the key. You know, for us in physical and health education, the key is to educate about the body, about training matters. I love, there's a program we deliver in the health and fitness unit where the end task is to teach the students how they can create a training program at home in their bedroom. So no resources, you know, no cost involved. So this is the end result. This is, you know, so this is what you can do yourself. This is what you can take control of, you know. So educating for me is the massive thing, and bringing conversations alive. And what I love is saying to students, I hated my body, mm-hmm. you know. Or if I see a student with braces, oh, I had braces, you know. Just giving that little, you know, I have to do a walk every morning when I drop my child off into primary. And I make it my business to see at least 4 students that I compliment on the way to my office. And if that works, great. And if everybody's doing that, and even if we're doing it to adults, we're making the place a better place.
And I think there's a lot to be said for complimenting and bolstering away from appearance, away from... Oh my goodness! I mean, it's also a very tricky line to tread when talking about appearance. But I think for me, it's that, you know, talking to your kids about social media, focusing less on that outward appearance, even if it is positive feedback. You know, talking about, you know, things that they're doing great. You know, and if they are struggling with that sense of body image, you know, sometimes it is a phase and sometimes it's more, much more critical. But to know that door is open for conversation as a teacher and as a parent. We've got lots of questions on this. Kieron, we have run out of time. We're going to be catching up next with Florence Gillet. But if anyone does want to contact you about the coaching and getting hold of your book as well, can you offer us some tips
yes,
there?
Yes, please reach out to me on Instagram, CMB Coach McBreen. And my book is available on all top bookstores and on Amazon and directly from me.
And for anyone who is struggling now themselves, if any teens are listening today and they're thinking, I can't even begin to imagine what it'd be like when I'm a grown up and, you know, I can't wait for this all this to be behind me. What would you say?
Firstly, I would say, you know, tell your parents how you're feeling, you know, because they can give you advice from experience. There's nothing as good as hindsight, you know, so please don't suffer alone would be the number one thing I would say.
And to come back to that comparison piece, stop comparing yourself. And we've said this before, you've got the power to curate your social media. You can surround yourself by people that inspire you and lift you up and make you feel great. And it could be recipe inspiration. It could be sports people you admire. You don't need to follow people that make you feel rubbish.
Absolutely.
And I would absolutely recommend following Kieron McBreen because he will not do that. And great one for parents and teens alike. Thank you so much, sir. Really do appreciate it. And if you do want details of the book, 4001.
Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
We're discussing body image, teens and children, and how a mother feels about her own body inevitably directly impact how her children will feel about their bodies. It's a mirror effect. One research study found that among 5 to 8 year olds, those who believed their mothers were unhappy in their bodies were more likely to have a poor body image themselves. So what does this mean? Plain and simple, if you're not walking your talk, your kids will know and you're more likely to pick up on your behaviours, the signals that you're unhappy in your body, negative self-talk, dieting and healthy eating behaviours. To help us unpick this and crucially answer your questions and concerns, Florence Gillet is with us, the founder of Beyond Body Image. She's also a certified eating psychology coach. Florence, thank you so much for being with us. This study out of the States just in the last week talking about 2/3 of parents believe their children have a negative body image. Do those numbers surprise you?
Hi, Helen. Thank you for having me today. Unfortunately, they don't surprise me. And we've seen this type of numbers for a while now. I've been a coach now for 4 years, mm-hmm. and it has been the case for that long. I don't think it's going to get any better immediately. I really hope that the next generation will be able to do things a little bit differently.
I hope so too. I really do. And as I said earlier to Kieron McBreen, this is a real aspect of parenting that I find very scary indeed. I don't want to pass my own body issues on to my kids. It's something I'm really consciously trying not to do. And we've had an awful lot of messages, questions, and I'm hoping you can help us out. Before we go to the text line, sure. though, Florence, I'm curious, you know, in what ways can we as parents nurture positive self-image and confidence in our kids?
Well, you said it before, it's really going to be first and foremost about dealing with our own body image issues. We can't teach something that we haven't mastered. It's going to be quite difficult to tell our kids, do what I say, but not the same as I do. You know how kids imitate what they see. So I think for anyone listening to us with that concern, it's going to be about understanding that body image is really in the mind. And you can change and improve your body image, whatever your body looks like today. Mm. So for parents feeling like there's no way I can accept the body I have right now, I can't do this work, I want them to be hopeful and realize that they can, because it's really more about neural pathways than actually changing their bodies physically.
And what about talking about food? It's such an emotional topic for lots of parents, you know, whether it's picky eating or perceived overeating. Any phrases to avoid, you know, any neutral language we could be incorporating to, I guess, just help our children have a healthy attitude towards what they eat?
Yes, definitely. I would say for me, it's about not labeling food in a kind of good or bad, or, you know, healthy versus junk. Any of these words, they're going to be quite loaded for our children, right? And it's going to be quite difficult for our kids, especially in primary age, to understand that they can want the quote unquote unhealthy or junk food and still be good kids. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it
does. So as much as possible, if you can, instead of labeling, it's really kind of eating as balanced as possible, realizing that having those foods that are typically deemed as unhealthy in our society today, they're also part of a balanced diet, and they should come into the diet as well, because they should not be loaded with shame. Mm-hmm. So that would be one of the ways. And then a great way to really foster a good eating competence in our children is to share family meals as much as possible.
Florence, I want to go to the text line. We've had a message here from Alistair saying, my teen is in denial that she's got an eating disorder despite seeing a variety of health specialists. Currently, as parents, we can ensure she eats enough to survive, but our greatest desire is to see her set free from the body dysmorphia and food fears. Will a psychologist be able to help her recognise her struggles and assist in mental health recovery?
So not only, yes, absolutely, a therapist will help, but also I would say, please, please bring your child to a specialist therapist. It's super important. You cannot just maintain the child at a certain weight and hope for the best. If the child has an illness, this is an illness, an eating disorder is a mental illness. In the same way, if your child has an illness of the thyroid, I'm saying anything, you would bring them to a doctor and they would be treated. Here, unfortunately, it cannot be something that you bring to any doctor, general practitioner. It has to be a specialist, and a therapist would be really a good idea. So if this person wants to reach out to me, I'm more than happy to recommend people.
Absolutely. I mean, I can only speak to people we've had on the show that I feel like are really valuable and specialise in this area. But Dr. Karine Elkazan from the Academy of Eating Disorders is fantastic. So I'd be very happy to send you her details, but also connect you with Florence and the team there at Beyond Body Image for some of the other recommendations. A question here from Rachel, a really great one, actually, saying, can you please recommend any books or websites on body image for my 13-year-old daughter to read? She loved What's Happening to Me when she was a bit younger, still reads it. I'm now looking for something in the same vein, slightly older and more focused on body image. I think it sounds like a great addition to any bookshelf. Is there any kind of preteen and teen books that you tend to recommend, Florence?
Yes, definitely. There's a few that I can think of. One of them was written by Sonia Renee Taylor. She's a fat activist who is really, really involved in anything around body image and fat acceptance. The title eludes me now, but Sonia Renee Taylor would be a great recommendation. She has books for teenagers and for parents as well. And there's definitely more and more coming. Celebrate Your Body and Its Changes Too.
Thank you. And no name on this message. And as we always say, whether it is our legal clinic or if we're talking health psychology, if you'd rather be anonymous, it's absolutely fine. We want to be giving the opportunity to connect with experts, get some reassurances, maybe some answers, an action plan. And anonymous asking this, Florence, saying, our daughter, who is 10 years old, has started talking about how she thinks she's fat. She isn't. She's above average height, athletic in shape, no tummy to speak of. We occasionally speak about healthy eating choices and exercise, but not a lot. I don't know where this comes from. We only talk about being and staying healthy, not skinny or thin or even slim. I've asked her if there's anything she wants to change in terms of food or activity, but she doesn't really seem to. She does plenty, swimming, netball, school, PE. I am conscious, and so is she, that her body is starting to change, and part of that will likely be curves. How do I not screw this up? I think that's probably the question that a lot of parents will be listening today. How can I navigate conversations where my daughter, my son, comes to me and says, I mean, Kieran was just talking there about he finds the word skinny really triggering, but in this situation about feeling fat, looking fat in their opinion, how do we not screw this up?
I can really feel the anxiety there. I really empathize with that. The first thing I would say is just listen. Do not let yourself as a parent be triggered by that, right? Because our emotions become like, oh, what's happening? But what we need to do at that time when the child comes and says, mommy, I feel fat, I hate my body, I feel disgusting, is to sit down and really say, honey, I hear this is really painful. Will you tell me more about what's going on? And I think this is a great way to allow for your child to kind of understand what is really hiding behind this. Because let's face it, that type of statement can show discomfort that is maybe not related to the body directly. And I think a lot of the times we're saying, okay, well, we'll help you feel better, more comfortable by changing your body. But we know it, once again, I'm going to say this, body image is actually in the mind. So we have to really open up the discussion, dig into what is really happening for the child, and then slowly understand, okay, how can we support the child in this challenge without it becoming about the body, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it absolutely does. And lastly, I wanted to ask you, social media for good. It's demonized a lot when it comes to body image, comparisons, airbrushing. Yeah. But it can be a great resource. And I think your account actually is a great example of that, Florence. But
thank you.
When it comes to teens in particular, are there any accounts or people or hashtags or anything that we could be filling our feeds with to help improve their body confidence?
Absolutely. I think what you want to do with your feed is really diversify the types of body you're going to see, because naturally social media algorithms will send to you the typical young, white, blonde female, you know, that is thin and looks a certain way. So some of the accounts that I find really helpful, one of them is the Nae Mercer's account, because she talks specifically about how people manipulate images to present themselves a certain way on social media. There are accounts also, because you mentioned some of the big issues for teenagers are acne, hair, weight. There are tons of accounts that are showing acne and skins that are imperfect, because I think if I had seen this for myself as a teen, I think it would have completely changed the way I look at myself. Absolutely. But it's also about maybe seeing people in larger bodies doing amazing things. There's this account called My Name is Jessamine.
I love her.
Yeah, so she is fat. And I'm using the word just as a descriptor, right? This is her choice as well. A fat woman who happens to also be Black, who is an amazing yoga teacher. And I think sometimes we tend to forget that we have body diversity in the world, and you can be in anybody and do anything you want. Mm-hmm. There is no restriction. So I would say those are the kind of accounts that I would recommend for young people to try and find. There are obviously tons on my website as well, but I would say, you know, let them just search potentially with a parent. You know, mm-hmm. as a parent, you want to have that discussion about social media with your child. Maybe you can actually look with them at what they're consuming on social media and then saying, hey, you know, have you seen this? My kids love Celeste Barber, for example.
Me too.
They find her super funny, and she does dismantle a little bit this idea of, like, you know, the posing and the perfect side of everything. So it's important kids see this. Mm-hmm. And that's, I would say, diversify as much as possible. Whoever you feel is responding to your needs as well, because we're all different, right?
Absolutely. And Florence, can I ask you, in terms of, I don't want to say services, but I guess support that you're offering here in the region, can you give us a little summary of who you're working with and some of the issues that are coming up, lastly?
Yeah, so I typically work with, mostly it's going to be women who are, you know, struggling with body image. Some of them, actually many of them, have lost their periods. So they went so much into dieting, over-exercising, that they end up without a menstrual cycle. I am a volunteer for the Middle East Eating Disorder Association, so I go and speak into schools, which I think would be relevant for the talk that we have today. Mm-hmm. I organize school talks for parents, but also for sixth form students. And I think in primary age, what we really want to focus is also sometimes on the school staff and really letting them know that, you know, people in that cafeteria, teachers, they all have their own biases as well. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they are not able to know what to say, what not to say. I have trained even doctors, school doctors sometimes, as to how to be as size inclusive and accepting of all bodies as much as possible.
Thank you. This
is a little bit what I do.
Florence, thank you so much for your time today. Some really valuable insights there. And if anyone does want to connect with you, I'd be happy to send your details, but you can be found on Instagram as beyondnoe.bodyimage. Thank you so much, Florence Gillet there. And if you do want her details, drop me a little line.
Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Great to have you with us. And World Heart Day takes place this Thursday. Its aim, of course, to raise awareness of cardiovascular diseases and learn how to prevent them, as well as what happens should you be diagnosed. And recent studies have unfortunately shown that more UA residents under the age of 30 are suffering with heart attacks. But why? Is it stress? Is it COVID? We are trying to find out this afternoon. Dr. Hawida Ibrahim is with us today. She's a family medicine specialist at House Call. Doctor, thank you for being with us. That's very shocking to me, the thought of younger people having heart attacks and heart conditions. When you look at patients coming through or look at worldwide studies as well, what are some of the reasons that you could perhaps point to for that?
I would like to thank you, Helen, for the opportunity.
You're welcome.
To talk to your audience. And I would like to thank Dubai Eye for giving House Call that chance. Yes, you are right. It's shocking news. And we have a lot of reason for that. Let me start with something we call it unmodifiable risk factor. Being in Middle East and Asia is known to be at higher risk than other world population. Heart disease started 10 years earlier when compared Middle East and Asian people to other world people. That is maybe due to genetics, maybe due to familial hypercholesterolemia, running families, that some families have high bad cholesterol. That might be the reason. And other reasons, we call it modifiable risk factor, that some risk factor we could work on it and modify it and protect. It's important topic because third of disease in UAE due to cardiovascular disease, and unfortunately half of them under age of 35.
That's so young. It's so young. And you know, unfortunately, we're also seeing people having heart attacks who perhaps are healthy, active, no previous medical conditions. Why do you think that's happening more and more?
Life changes. Lifestyle changes a lot. Sanitary lifestyle. We are using cars more than we are walking. Diet. Also, we need to, our diet is now going with eating more bad foods and healthier food. We drop vegetable and fruits or decrease it. And stress, life stress is number one killer, because stress will increase the bad cholesterol, will reduce the good cholesterol. Stress can cause obesity, hypertension, diabetes. And let me add smoking. 20% of UAE adult is a smoker. Smoking 20%. Also put more effect on heart and causing heart disease.
20%, goodness. We're taking your questions this afternoon, and we've already had a number for you, Doctor. More of a comment here from Isabel saying, I read an interesting article on how women's symptoms of heart disease have been ignored, misdiagnosed, dismissed, because research historically was based on male patients. I had no idea how different the causes of heart attacks were in men and women, or the effects of menopause or loss of estrogen. Is this something that perhaps we need to be highlighting more, Doctor?
Yes, we know that male is more had more risk to have heart disease, but female after menopause they will be the higher risk because of estrogen is protecting female hearts, and when we lack estrogen, that protection will fall down. Mm-hmm. And also, symptom is same like sometimes you feel heartburn, you will feel muscle pain, and it is at the end it is heart attack, is not heartburn. Or indigestion, or muscle pain, or vomiting, or no, will be underlying cause is heart attack. And because that symptom are common in female, people ignore it or think that it might be due to GI, gastrointestinal symptom or others.
Dr. Hawida this afternoon, family medicine specialist at House Call, joining us, talking World Heart Day.
This content is for informational purposes only and does not intend to substitute professional medical advice, diagnosis or treatment. Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Now, though, we are marking World Heart Day. It takes place this Thursday, and joining us live on the line to answer my questions and yours is Dr. Hawida Ibrahim, family medicine specialist at House Call. Interestingly, Dr. Hawida, I just saw in the news just last night about detecting atrial fibrillation with wearable gadgets. So, you know, like the watch I'm wearing now, well, maybe not this one because it needs upgrading, being able to pick up on any abnormalities about your heart, you know, misfiring. There was a trial involved about 5,000 adults aged 50 to 90 who were considered to be at risk of a stroke but didn't have AF to their knowledge using an app. And I wondered where you think this could go. You know, in your professional opinion, do you feel like gadgets could be helpful in diagnosing heart issues?
Yes, that is true, because the main idea, as we said previously, cardiovascular disease is number one killer.
So in terms of the more awareness we have of our own
accident.
Health.
Mm-hmm. So whatever there is a chance to detect the cardiovascular disease earlier, that will help a lot, because that is the key factor. Know the risk, manage it, modify it, then... Because 80% of cardiovascular risk is modifiable, and we can prevent it if we know it. So using watch, using apps, if it helps us to detect early the disease early, that would be fantastic and better and life-saving.
Doctor, let's talk prevention. You mentioned earlier there are some risk factors, and of course, lifestyle being a big one. Smoking being key. 20% of UAE adults smoking. Hereditary factors as well. But we do have some things within our control. You know, it doesn't have to be an inevitable destiny. In many cases, what would you like to have everyone this afternoon listening do, or change, or try in order to protect their heart and keep it healthy for as long as possible?
At least we can manage our weight by walking. You know, it's known that if you walk at least 4,000 steps per day, that might help a lot. And if you make it up to 10,000, that would reduce the risk of dying from heart attack by 30%. And definitely it varies according to the age. Young people can walk more, and elderly, you can accept up to 5,000 steps per day to protect their heart. Mm-hmm. That easy, and anyone can do it. And also diet, eat more fruits, more vegetable, that will help a lot. And for a smoker, we advise them to quit smoking as soon as possible, because now they will have no effect. When they get older, they will have effect on their arteries, and it might be a cause of coronary heart disease or stroke. And stress, manage stress very well, mm-hmm. because life is full of stresses, and if we know how to manage our stress appropriately, that will help a lot.
It's interesting, because almost every single medical expert I've had on the show over the last couple of weeks has talked about stress, from dermatologists to psychiatrists. You're speaking now as a family medicine specialist. It feels like there's a lot of overwhelm and anxiety and stress around at the moment. And there's no one size fits all for mitigating that stress and treating it. You've got to find what works for you. Dr. Hawida, really do appreciate your time this afternoon. I don't want to say happy World Heart Day, but you know, why not? I'm sure it's something you say in the medical community. So wishing you and the team there at House Call all the very best for the week ahead. And up next, we're having a look at some, a story behind some of that data around heart conditions. We've got Hannah joining us in the studio on hand to explain what she's been through as a baby and also now.
This content is for informational purposes only. If you would like to seek medical treatment, please contact a certified healthcare provider for personalized advice and diagnosis. Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
We are marking World Heart Day. It falls on Thursday, and we've just been in conversation there with Dr. Hawida about some of the risk factors. A lot of them there, just talking about lifestyle, obviously maintaining a healthy weight, about walking, about giving up smoking. But one thing we didn't touch on is what it's like to be born with a heart defect, a condition. And Hannah joining us in the studio now, one young woman who knows exactly what it's like to live with heart disease. She's joining us to explain a little bit about what life is like now. Hannah, but I'd love you to take us back, and I know you will not remember those early days, but what was it that you were born with, and what were the circumstances around your birth?
Thank you so much for having me on. I was born 3 months premature. Surprised my parents on their wedding anniversary, as you do. And I was at 6 months, I caught meningitis of the brain. And that's when doctors discovered that actually the hole in the heart that they saw when I was born prematurely, which is quite common in premature babies, that hole was actually something much bigger, a much bigger complication. And I was diagnosed with a congenital heart disease called complicated Epstein's anomaly. It's a disease that counts for 1% of all congenital heart disease, so it's quite rare. Obviously, I like to do things in an odd way, but that's fine. And I wish I could sit here and tell you the science behind it. But as a child, I chose to kind of block that out. My parents were dealing with a lot of that. Mm-hmm. But it's meant that I've had a lot of operations, a lot of instays, you know, inpatient stays at hospital. And I now live with a pacemaker just to kind of keep me ticking.
Tell us a little bit about then being a child who was in and out of hospital. And I guess, do you felt like that defined you as a kid at school? Did that mark you out as being a bit different? Or were your parents doing a job of shielding you from those kind of differences?
Do you know, I grew up fortunately with parents who never mollycoddled me. So I was very lucky in that respect. But obviously in school, you know, when you've got purple lips and you're a bit shorter than everyone else, like I didn't really grow that much until I was about 9 years old. I had open heart surgery when I was 9. And, you know, children, they comment on that, and not to be malicious or nasty, but because, you know, you stand out a little bit.
And kids often have no filter. We can do all we can to talk about differences and inclusion and representation, but sometimes you're like, there's no filter at all. What was that like for you?
I had my ups and downs. Secondary school was really hard for me. I was in and out of hospital all the time. I think at that time, I didn't know as a young person how to navigate my own health. Mm-hmm. You know, you're kind of in and out of hospital, but you're not really taught how to become independent in the world living with something like that. Mm-hmm. And for me, that was actually more challenging than primary because, you know, I was known as a bit of, you know, ambulance girl, and there was always an issue, and I had 4 surgeries out of the 5 years I was at secondary school. So I think, you know, in young people's minds, it's kind of like, oh, why is she skipping school? You know, it's almost seen as like a privilege, but actually what I'm going through is not really that fun.
I'm sure you would have much preferred to have been in the classroom. And you said you've got a pacemaker now. What's your overall health like now, Hannah?
My overall health is okay. I still have my days where I'm like, oh, not too sure how this is going to go, you know, but then again, I'm human. So, but I still have regular checkups at the hospital every 6 months or so now. But technology is amazing. I know you were talking about that before with the doctor, and obviously all my doctors are back home, but I'm actually monitored from here. So my heart can kind of almost be controlled from anywhere in the world, which is a bit mental.
That is amazing though. That is really incredible. And you're dedicating a lot of your time and energies to obviously raising awareness around heart health, but also making sure that young patients have a smooth hospital experience. Mm. Can you tell us about that?
For me, there was a time when I hit 16 that you moved from children's to adult services. And that was a really turbulent time for me in terms of you go from play therapy, cinema, school, you know, school in the hospital, TV, to literally just what feels like just a big white room. And, you know, when you train to become a doctor or a nurse, you kind of train in children's or you train in adults. You don't train anywhere in between. Mm-hmm. And one of the big things for me that I really worked on was actually resources for young patients in hospitals. So my friend and I, Katie, we wrote a manual, one of the first written by patients for patients on pacemakers. Because when I had mine in, I was handed like a 72-page booklet.
As if you're ever going to read it.
Like full of
or
medical
understand
jargon.
It. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And that was it. And it was, you know, I think there was this big misconception at the time that pacemakers are for older patients. Mm-hmm. You know, they are for your grandma or your granddad. And so all the pictures were like of old people gardening or like cycling. And I'm like, no, I can't
deal
with this.
I want to go out dancing.
Yeah.
And also, I suppose that by patients, for patients piece is really important because a lot of your consultants, I'm sure none of them would have had pacemakers themselves. They wouldn't know what it's like to have this equipment, to be thinking about things that were coming to you for day-to-day life and the bigger picture as well. there might be sympathy and but not real a sense of genuine understanding of what someone's going through.
Yeah, and I think even on an emotional level, you know, like we go through that journey, we've been through it together, both of us had met in hospital, had pacemakers, and so it was more about taking these patients on a journey as opposed to like, this is what you have and this is how to understand it.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. And you've worked with charities in the UK and met the Queen. Earlier this year, you were in the Queen's Honours list with a British Empire medal. What was that like to get that recognition?
Do you know what? I don't do this to receive. So for me, when that letter came through, it was a few years ago because obviously the pandemic hit and everything. I just remember like it was November 12th or something, 2019. And I just was like crying in my front room. My parents were like, what is going on? I was just so overwhelmed that, you know, someone would see a genuinity in me and just a kindness that they wanted to recognise, because I really wasn't doing it for that. And then, you know, when you're there in Buckingham Palace in May, I took my dad along with me and it was just like, we were both just like, wow, we're eating sandwiches on the grounds of Buckingham Palace. This is crazy.
What a moment. And can I ask lastly, Hannah, for any parents out there who are navigating this as a family, maybe it's with a baby with a hole in their heart, or maybe it's with a child who's in and out of hospital, what advice would you give to anyone who is dealing with, you know, an ongoing heart condition?
Communicate. Look after yourselves. I think at the end of the day, you know best. Like, we all know our bodies best. And to just ask questions. No question is stupid. And to just ask for help when you need it.
You're also a big advocate about making hearts happy in all aspects. A big advocate of play. If anyone wants to follow your journey, find out more about Yalla Play, which you're involved in as well, what's the best way of getting in touch with you?
You can do so on Instagram, hannah.pips or yallaplay.ae on Instagram.
Thank you so much. I think it's really wonderful to obviously have you in and smiling and so healthy and happy, because I think for a lot of parents to get a diagnosis like that and to think about what their child's childhood is going to be like it's a really scary process, I'm sure.
Yeah.
And to have you on the other side of that and kind of really shining a light on what can be is really, really powerful. So thank you so much.
No, thank you for having
me. Keep up the good work and yeah, happy World Heart Day.
Yeah.
Shall we say that?
Yeah,
okay.
Thank
happy
you.
World Heart Day to you for Thursday.
You <too. laughs>
Hannah Phillips joining us in the studio. If you do want details of her or indeed Yalla Play, please do get in touch. I'm here on 4001. You've got your ARN Play app and the WhatsApp too.
Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
We are talking health this afternoon. Joining us live on the line from King's College Hospital is Dr. Morelli Subramaniam. He is a consultant vascular surgeon, 3 decades of surgical experience. He has been working in the NHS in the UK, set up an award-winning diabetic foot clinic, and has also been a very instrumental when it comes to varicose veins treatment and setting up a day surgery for them as well. So we are talking veins today, taking your questions on anything and everything. So let me know if you do have any questions. Dr. Morelli, how are you this afternoon?
Hi, Helen. How are you?
I'm really well. Really well, thank you. I have to say, after doing a bit of research into varicose veins today, pretty grateful I haven't got any. But I'm sure you've seen some over the years. We're going to be talking about some of the treatments and identification.
Sure.
But before we get to my questions and those coming in on the text line, I'm curious, what attracted you to this area of medicine, to vascular surgery in particular?
Oh, interesting. Well, the thing is, you see, always I wanted to do surgery, and in fact, I wanted to do cardiac surgery. But I thought vascular is you do a similar type of surgery, but better quality of life.
Interesting. Well, it's kind of fortuitous you're on the show today, because my daughter fell asleep last night, and the last question she asked me before she fell asleep, and I apologize for any potential bad language, she said, "Mummy, if there's lots of blood in our body, why doesn't it fall out of our bum hole?" And my answer was veins.
Yeah.
And I hope I got that right.
Veins, arteries.
So I'm glad I've got a doctor to kind of qualify that answer. Doctor, you've been in the UAE only quite recently. I'm just curious, has anything surprised you about what's been coming into clinic that perhaps wasn't in the UK, or any kind of trends, behaviours that you're seeing that, you know, you've thought, oh, I wasn't expecting that?
No, that's true. The thing is, you see, I mean, we used to do a lot of arterial work. I mean, back in the NHS, you know, we used to do surgery for to prevent strokes, a lot of aneurysms, you know, in the aorta, lower limb bypass and stuff like that. But here, my clinic, if you can give a name to it, you can call it the leg pain clinic.
Okay.
So I'm getting a lot of people with pain in the legs. I mean, it can be due to several causes. Of course, vascular causes such as varicose veins is one cause. You can have blockage in your arteries, which can cause pain in the legs. So that's what I'm seeing a lot here.
Doctor, can I ask you, I would imagine, and I'm totally projecting and guessing here, is there any confusion around what could be coming to you? Because when you say leg pain, I mean, could it problem, it could be vascular. How do you then start to ascertain which specialist somebody needs to see?
See, the thing is, most of them, you know, joint pains are very typical. You know, they tend to go to the orthopedicians. People, especially with, you know, what we call silent varicose veins, where there's a leaky valve, but you don't have the bulging veins like you see, you know. So those type of people, they tend to go around to various specialties, and then they come to me, and they don't have the bulging veins, but they still have the same problem, which is the leaky valves, which gives them pain in the legs, heaviness, you know, sometimes itching and stuff like that.
We are going to go to the text line next. We're lucky enough to have stolen away consultant vascular surgeon Dr. Murali from King's College Hospital.
This content is for informational purposes only and does not intend to substitute professional medical advice, diagnosis or treatment. Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Joining us live on the line from King's College Hospital is Dr. Murali. He is here as consultant vascular surgeon, decades of experience. We've also had questions, as I mentioned, he set up a multidisciplinary diabetic foot clinic. So we're having a question on diabetes, but we're also talking about varicose veins and all sorts of different vascular issues as well. Doctor, let's go to the text line, if you don't mind. We had a little focus on your leg pain and some of the symptoms that people are having with varicose veins. With a message here from Salia saying, I'm 26 weeks pregnant and in my last pregnancy 2 years ago, I developed a varicose vein in my left inner thigh. It starts just above the knee but goes all the way up to my pelvis with 5 large lumps. It disappeared after the last pregnancy but has reappeared. Every night I'm waking up with pain. It hurts for 15 minutes when walking on it. Is this normal or does it need to be checked?
Yeah, I would say you see pregnancy, you know, as you know, the fetus can compress on the veins and it's not surprising that she's got it back. What I would say is consult a vascular surgeon or you can come over to see us here. She will need a scan to see if there are any leaky valves, which I think she will have. And usually the treatment is after pregnancy. I generally don't do any procedures at this stage. She might need stockings or something like that just to keep things under control for now. And then after the delivery of the baby, then we can do a definitive procedure.
Hope that helps, Salih. All the very best for the rest of the pregnancy. Janine's saying, I had the laser treatment for my veins and it was brilliant, painless and very effective. The veins had gone completely. There were 2 sessions. 5 years later, no sign of them. My mother had the stripping out. That sends shivers down my spine. The stripping out procedure many years ago and she said it was horrendous. Which leads me to ask you, Doctor, what does treatment look like now and what can happen if, you know, severe varicose veins go untreated?
Well, see, varicose veins, if they're not treated, you can have leg ulcers, you can skin discoloration, very rarely you can have bleeding from the varicose veins. The treatment options these days are, we do it all minimally invasive. Of course, during my training days, we used to do a lot of the stripping procedure, but we don't, it is very rare these days. Of course, I've not done them in quite a while now. Mm-hmm. Usually it is a laser procedure, it's a keyhole procedure. They come in the morning, go home in the afternoon. So it's fairly safe and fairly reliable. and a very good cosmetic results as well.
And we've got a message here on 4001, no name, and it's absolutely fine to send in a message without a name for questions for any of our experts, saying, I'm 54 years old, have spider veins on my ankles and thighs. How can one get rid of them?
Yeah, you can, we can, of course, we have to consult to make sure there's no other truncal issues. You know, the main veins are okay, and if there are no other issues to deal with, then the spider veins can be treated with injection or with laser fiber. So it is, again, very durable treatment. So I think she will need to consult a vascular surgeon.
Can I ask about the heat? You just moved recently to the UAE. You've been in the UK for a long time. Does the summer or heat have any impact on varicose veins?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I'm not really very sure, but you can have a dilatation of veins, I suppose, if the temperature is very high.
Just curious.
Yeah.
We had a message here from Dana saying, is it true that HRT can make varicose veins worse?
Well, I mean, some of the hormones can cause dilatation of veins, and it doesn't happen to everybody for whatever reason. Yes, it may do so. First of all, we need to make sure there's an alternative treatment the person can receive if it makes it worse, or this other option is to treat the varicose veins or control it.
This content is for informational purposes only. If you would like to seek medical treatment, please contact a certified healthcare provider for personalized advice and diagnosis. Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Delighted to be talking health this afternoon with Dr. Murali. He's consultant vascular surgeon there at King's College Hospital. He's got 3 decades of surgical experience. He was formerly consultant with the NHS in the UK, set up a multidisciplinary diabetic foot clinic, and has also introduced a novel, minimally invasive treatment for varicose veins. So please do reach out if any of these topics, really anything relating to the vascular system, is on your mind or you've got any questions. Dr. Murali, a message here, no name, it's absolutely fine to be anonymous if you're getting in touch on anything like this, saying, at what point do varicose veins need treatment and what kind of pain can they cause? Great question about when you should actually go and see an expert.
Fantastic. See, I have 3 types of patients with varicose veins. The first one is somebody who has very prominent veins and they are symptomatic, i.e. they have pain, heaviness, they get fatigued, they have, discoloration in the skin, and they are itching as well. So these are patients who are symptomatic, who have varicose veins, and they need treatment. Okay, the other group is they have varicose veins but have no symptoms, they want it removed for cosmetic reasons, which is fine, and that's the other group. The third group is the group which they have what we call silent varicose veins, where they have the same pathology as the ones who have this florid varicose veins, where the valves are leaky and they have heaviness in the legs. And since they don't have varicose veins, they tend to go to several other specialties and finally end up to see me. And then once we do a scan, you see there's a leaky valve. And if once that is fixed, the pain and heaviness, swelling and all these things go away.
Thank you for that. Really hope that helps. Now, as I mentioned, you were there working in the UK around diabetes, and you were you're credited with significant reduction in major amputations. So I'm hoping you can help out Hassan here, who says, both my parents have type 2 diabetes, but dad has been having problems with his feet for a while. Doctor said it was gout, nothing to be done. Eventually, he has been to the chiropodist and diagnosed neuropathy, which is quite extensive. For the first time in a long time, I saw his feet at the weekend. Several toes have black patches. The whole of his right foot is cool and not pink. So does your doctor know how fast this might progress to losing the foot? He's very worried about it, as am I, obviously, but we'd like to know. Hassan, thank you for reaching out. Dr. Murali, I know it's very hard to give any kind of diagnosis or timeline over the phone.
Well, I mean, if the foot is cold, that needs urgent attention. They need take it to an emergency department ASAP. It's not very commonly known, but the diabetic patients have a 16-fold increase in limb loss. Mm-hmm. So they have to. What I commonly say is, look after your feet like your face. It might sound a bit funny, but that's what they have to do. Look after it. Make sure if there are any little cuts or sores to reach out to a physician as soon as possible, because they don't have sensation. They tend to leave things for a longer duration. And by the time they come to the A&E or to meet a doctor, sometimes it is too late. Mm-hmm. So that's the reason why if you're a diabetic, you need to be very, very careful. And if there's one sentence, one message you want to take home today, if you're a diabetic, look after your feet like your face.
Hassan, time to give your dad a call. And if you want to be connected with Dr. Murali, by all means, let me know and I can send you his details. He's there at King's College Hospital. No name on this message saying, can the doctor cover hemorrhoids if they reoccur but respond to cream? Does it need to be treated? Asking for my husband who won't. can you offer any advice there, Dr. Murali?
Well, of course, hemorrhoids is to do with veins, but I don't treat them. They have to seek a consultation with the colorectal surgeon. There are several lovely colleagues of mine here, they will definitely be able to help.
I will send. I'll send you the website over there. Let's quickly, if you don't mind, kind of summarise with a bit about vein health, if you don't mind, Dr. Murali, because I'm sure people listening today will either fall into the category of, yes, this is something I'm concerned about, and others going, well, I've never noticed a varicose vein. It's not in my family. I'm not particularly concerned. But for those who are lucky enough to be unaffected and want to stay that way, is there anything that the general population can do to improve overall vascular health?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Staying fit, if you can, if you're overweight, try and cut down your weight. Stay fit, avoid constipation, long walks, exercises, all of them help to keep your veins healthy, your circulation going. And if there's any issues, come see us.
What role does diet play, can I ask, when we're thinking about, thickening of veins, any artery problems? We were talking earlier about heart health, so, avoiding smoking, quitting smoking. But is there any significance of diet, low in cholesterol, for example? I've got no idea, but in an ideal world, what would you advise?
Well, I would say, if you extend it, if you can avoid constipation, and that can you can avoid having veins. I mean, it's a kind of a extended kind of theory, mm-hmm. but a high fiber diet might it's a general health tip. Maintain your weight, have a healthy exercise regime, and a good diet and with a lot of fiber. I mean, that's.
And I'm going to squeeze in one last question. This is from Ash saying, do you need to be more concerned about varicose veins if you have high blood pressure? I have no idea. What do you think, doctor?
Well, the thing is, if your blood pressure is high, obviously the hydrostatic pressure in the veins mm-hmm. is high, And you could have, if it's extremely high, you can have, and if the veins are very big and very close to the skin, you can potentially have bleeding from the veins, So yes, I would say control your blood pressure.
It always comes back to the sensible stuff. It always comes back to, just the common sense things that we all know we should do, but sometimes we don't always do. Being active, healthy body weight, not smoking, you know, all of that. And if anyone is wanting to contact you regarding varicose veins or indeed any of the topics that we've touched on today, and we didn't even get onto some of the things that you address in clinic, can they come and see someone such as yourself, a vascular expert, direct? Or do you need to get a referral from a family medicine doctor or a general GP?
No, not at all. They can come and see me directly. At King's College, they can call our call centre, book an appointment, and come and see us directly.
Dr. Mal, I really do appreciate your time. Thank you so, so much. Get back to clinic. I know you're incredibly busy right now. And if you do want the doctor's details, drop me a little message on 4001. I'd be happy to send the link for him and his colleagues at King's College.
This content is for informational purposes only and does not intend to substitute professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
And thank you for downloading this episode of the Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast. Don't forget, you can subscribe. You'll get direct to your phone as soon as it's out. And you can listen to me live on Dubai Eye 103.8, Monday to Friday between 2 and 5 p.m.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.